You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hi, Jim.
Hi, Bob.
How you doing?
I'm all right. How about you?
I'm doing fine. Let me introduce this. I'm Robert Wright. This is The Wright Show. You are Jim Loeb, possibly the leading authority on the landscape of foreign policy opinion as it plays out in Washington, D.C. Is that the way you would describe yourself?
No. Okay. Why it's so...
I may be getting you mixed up with someone else. Tell us who you are.
I'm a modest person who was bureau chief for Interpress Service, international news agency, for about 30 years here. Mm-hmm. But I focused in the last two on the blog that I produced called Loblog.
It's more than a blog. You're selling yourself short again.
All right.
It is Loblog, L-O-B-E-L-O-G, modestly named after yourself, but it features largely work by other people. I mean, it's a really high volume, it's become a high volume thing.
Well, it does feature work by other people. Mm-hmm. I don't contribute to it all that often, although sometimes I make suggestions to authors.
Mm-hmm. So you have a quasi-editorial role at Loblog.
Yeah, pretty quasi.
Pretty quasi.
Yeah.
Okay. So we're going to talk about the Trump administration. Let me quote from the last piece you wrote. We're going to talk about the future direction of the Trump administration's, let's just say, ever evolving foreign policy.
I think that's a fair
thing to say, that it changes, that it's a fluid thing at the moment. So here was the lead for the last piece you wrote for Loblog. 36 hours after the pre-dawn cruise missile strike against Syria's al-Shayrat airfield, neoconservative hawks, many of whom beat the drums for war in Iraq 14 years ago, are feeling the warm spring breezes of renewal and rejuvenation. Suddenly hopeful that Donald Trump may yet be coming around to their worldview, neoconservatives are full of praise for the action, which they, like many liberal interventionists, insist was long overdue. Not surprisingly, neocons are pressing for more. Now, one reason this is interesting, and maybe this is the last thing I'll say by way of framing this conversation in a big way, is that we seem to be in a period where Steve Bannon's influence is waning. And in the realm of foreign policy, Steve Bannon's view was associated with Trump's view pre-election, I guess you might say. In any event, he opposed the Syria strikes. And one question that arises is, if he is a waning influence, what will fill his place? Well, as you suggest, neocons would be happy to play that role. Not that they are an entirely homogeneous group. There are different neocons and so on. But broadly speaking, that would be a natural candidate. And we'll talk about the prospects for that, whether there are any other candidates. But first, why don't we just, as a refresher, remind people, what was Trump saying before the election about foreign policy, and how would you characterize the worldview that represented?
Of Trump.
Trump. What was Trump's foreign? What did Trump's foreign policy worldview seem to be before the election?
Well, not particularly consistent, but I suppose during the campaign, of course, it was defined primarily by his Islamophobia and his anti-immigration and general this notion of America first, I would call it by and large Jacksonian, which pretty much corresponded to Steve Bannon's view as we know it. And obviously it was Bannon who tried to make Trump understand how he was fulfilling America's destiny as laid out by Andrew Jackson so many years ago.
That's Andrew, not Scoop, just to be clear.
Well, there are important differences.
We should remind people who Scoop was. Scoop Jackson was a senator who, though a Democrat, was a hawk. And I would say, isn't he a little bit associated with neoconservatism himself, or is that going too far?
I think it's fair to say that I would say that his office when he was senator from Washington, or if you like, the senator from Boeing, his office in Washington was a hatchery served as a hatchery for some of the most important Washington neoconservatives. That is kind of the the doers and shakers of neoconservatism in Washington, in politics.
Like who?
Well, Richard Perle worked for him. Elliot Abrams worked for him. Doug Feith had a position there for a period of time. Frank Gaffney, who's now kind of gone off the deep end into serious Islamophobia, which I think would have offended Scoop Jackson himself, because I don't think he held those kinds of prejudices mm-hmm. at all. But, and I would say generally that Scoop was a liberal hawk par excellence, but only when he ran for president did he kind of, well, he did more than embrace, he helped shape the kind of neoconservative movement in the early 70s.
Okay, so it's another kind of Jacksonian that Trump was before the election, the Andrew kind, and that meant, I take it, I mean, you mentioned the phrase America first. First of all, like, not intervening militarily, except when it's clearly in America's national interest, right? And
but we can take the oil wells, remember.
Well, right. Taking their oil would be in America's interest. Of course, yeah. I mean, we should also say that in general, Trump's rhetoric has been characterized by a certain departure from reality sometimes. So, like, when he says, we'll take their oil, I don't think he's really figured on the logistical challenges. But in any event, the idea is you only intervene in the name of America's self-interest, and none of this humanitarian intervention stuff. On the other hand, if you need to intervene for America's self-interest, the idea would be, in this view, you are unconstrained by international institutions. You don't worry about what the UN thinks, maybe even what NATO thinks. And the Syria strike was a good example of that, right? He didn't do a whole lot of consultation. We just did it.
Right. Yes. I completely agree with that.
So that part, you might think that the Syria strike was a good example of America first. But there is the question of, was it really in America's vital national interest? Steve Bannon didn't think so. He reportedly opposed it.
Right.
And in general, the people who had been on board with the American first rhetoric before the election opposed it. And
right.
There was this rationale for it being America, you know, in America's interest that, well, we need to deter, you know, chemical weapons use and so on. But the real America firsters considered that kind of a strained rationale. So basically, in this view...
Well, no, I mean, it was also a rationale. I mean, that's what was kind of so interesting about his statement and subsequent statements out of the administration, that it was to uphold the Chemical Weapons Treaty, an international treaty. And remember how he signed off in that statement, which just struck me like lightning, where he said... God bless America, pause, and the entire world, which, I mean, you can't get more globalist than that. I mean, Bannon must have been extremely upset by wording like that.
Now, Bannon definitely doesn't want God to bless the entire world. He wants God to bless the Judeo-Christian part of the world.
So long as it remains strictly Judeo-Christian.
Precisely.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that is, you're right, and you know, it's. I noted that they were implicitly kind. They were explicitly anyway, showing respect for the whatever it's called, the Organization for Whatever of Chemical Weapons, which was created with the Chemical Weapons Convention. And if you remember, the Chemical Weapons Convention barely got ratified because there was a lot of opposition within the Republican Party,
and there were reservations. To it. I mean, Jesse Helms was a big obstacle until he got his reservations.
Right. So it's kind of, it is odd that given not only what Trump had said before the election, but just given the fact that he's a Republican in a way, or a certain, you know, a conservative Republican as he's currently styling himself, that they would be singing the praises of the Chemical Weapons Convention. So that certainly represents a departure from America First.
Yes, I without any doubt.
And as you said, this was praised really across the board. I mean, by what was what Ben Rhodes, Obama's you know, kind of national security aide and speechwriter, characterized as the blob, meaning just the kind of the whole Washington foreign policy establishment, from liberal interventionists to neocon, which together constitute, you know, a large majority of the Washington foreign policy establishment. It was praised by the blob.
Yeah, I think it was praised also. I mean, I would say that was greater than just neocons and liberal interventionists. I mean, there were a number of softer liberal internationalists who went along with it, but there was also a substantial number of, let's say, you know, fairly hard-eyed realists. And I think that reflects the military.
So would the soft internationalists, first of all, would those be like Nick Kristof?
Yeah, for example.
And then who would be the realists who favored it?
Well, I think people like, I associate it more with Center for Strategic and International Studies as kind of being the core of that. The reason being that, more for its international implications, to say that this was really helpful in writing the impression that the United States was retreating from the world, had begun to retreat from the world.
Yeah.
It was seen as a demonstration that the Obama years, you know, in terms of being so scrupulous about not intervening, were, you know, finally over. And as a reassurance to specific allies, especially Gulf allies or allies in the Gulf, mm-hmm. you know, who've been calling for this kind of action for forever, and who, to the hard-eyed realists, including the military, are very important to kind of keep on our side or keep reassuring.
Yeah, I wonder, I mean, is it a natural realist position? I mean, maybe we should define realist. Realists, well, first of all, unburdened by a lot of, like, you know, humanitarian-type empathy. They are realist in that sense. I mean, they realists, well, you might say that Donald Trump before the election was something of a realist. Realists emphasize American national security. The average realist may have a more encompassing vision of America's national security than Trump was evincing, but that core thing they have in common. I mean, some of them have a certain amount of respect for international institutions as a necessary medium by which we exercise the influence we exercise and so on, but some so overlap, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a spectrum of people, and you can have progressive realists, you know. Such
you could, as, if there was more than me on using that term, you could.
I can relate to that term.
Yeah.
But then you can have kind of more conservative realists, and conservative in institutional terms, even in economic terms. I mean, if you consider, for example, our Gulf allies to be important because, for one thing, they help maintain the American military's industrial base by ordering so much equipment. they keep things humming.
I'm not sure Hans Morgenthau would recognize that as a central plank of realism.
No, I don't think Morgenthau would recognize it, but I think in a place like the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
Well, let's, you know.
The Center for the New American Security, which is more of a democratic institution, I think, you know, these people are realists, and they consider the Gulf allies as a major example to be very important.
Well,
and,
yes.
And people we need to reassure all the time.
Well, and in the Center for Strategic and International Studies also considers the Gulf allies important as people who give money to the Center for Strategic and International Studies. I mean, Glenn Greenwald tweeted today that, you know, CSIS gets money from Turkey and the Sunni Arab states.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, you look at the United Arab Emirates, and they've got money in virtually every quote-unquote mainstream think tank in Washington, D.C. I mean, CAP, Center for American Progress, just put out another article that was co-written by a former member of the Supreme National Security Council of the UAE, which gave CAP $700,000 last year And this report essentially takes UAE's line even on Yemen, which mm-hmm. is kind of controversial among progressives. Yes, I think the fact that they helped fund it does affect the analysis even of realists.
Jim, I'd just like to take this opportunity to say that I am available for co-authoring papers with former UAE officials, should any of them deem that to be appropriate. Okay?
They could take that very seriously. They're very sophisticated. And James Mattis thinks very highly of them.
Yeah. Now, one interesting thing about all this money from Sunni Arab states is that to some extent, there's some degree of convergence with pro-Israel money, right? Which has also been known to find its way into the occasional Washington think tank.
That is something that Bibi Netanyahu in particular is pushing very hard, and his backers here, who are almost all neoconservatives, also want to believe that there is a great strategic alliance to be struck, and that is in the process even of being stricken. Is that the right word?
Yeah.
Of being struck between the Gulf Arabs, the Sunni Gulf Arabs, and Israel. Most, I think, more sophisticated analysts believe that the price for that will be something on Israel-Palestine, but Bibi and his backers here keep pushing it in any event.
Yeah, and first I should say, by the way, when I say pro-Israel, I guess I should specify kind of right-wing pro-Israel, because, for example, J Street considers itself pro-Israel. I think legitimately so. In fact, I think its vision of the future is more in Israel's interest than some alternatives in the so-called Israel lobby. But with that said, maybe we should flesh out what the convergence of interest is. It's to a large extent, it's like being anti-Iran, right? It's like Israel considers Iran the greatest single threat, I think, among nation states to its national security, probably.
Through Hezbollah in particular.
And of course, both Hezbollah and Iran are allied with Syria, the Syrian regime. And if the Sunni states are also skittish about Israel, I mean about Iran and the Syrian regime, you can see how they might all see eye to eye, which brings us back to these missile strikes, which of course were targeted at the Syrian regime.
Yes. Well, we don't know if they were targeted at the regime or specifically at the airfield, which allegedly delivered the weapons.
Well, right, but I mean, it's a regime airfield is what I mean.
Right, that's true. But we don't know whether the intention is regime change.
Right, but this is a big question. If we get back to the question of who is going to be exerting it, you know, what foreign policy vision is taking shape in the administration? Or in other words, what ideology will fill any void left by Bannon's waning influence?
Right.
To the extent that it is neoconservative, would you expect regime change to be among the aspirations evinced?
Well, to the extent that it's neoconservative, regime change would be on the agenda, but I don't see them exerting that kind of influence, at least not yet.
Okay.
They have a major opportunity here. They see a major opportunity here. But whether they can take full advantage of it or whether there are obstacles in their path, that's not clear at all. Well, I think it's a more difficult proposition for them.
Yeah. And why is that? I mean, in a certain sense, you might argue that, look, if the kind of Jacksonian, you know, nationalists lose power, all that's left is neocons, right? I mean, the Republican foreign policy establishment is essentially neocon, right? I mean, there's not much of a realist wing left in the actual Republican establishment, is there?
Well, when you talk about the Republican establishment, if you're talking about Congress and the Republican caucus in Congress, I think that's pretty much right. But obviously there are institutions in the U.S. government, the military, the intelligence community, the State Department, albeit diminished, they have voices, and some of them are kind of Republican. I would say certainly among the military, is historically leans to Republican, and that's where the hard-eyed CSIS type realists come in, because I think they often reflect the Pentagon's interest, and the Pentagon funds them too, I believe, in various ways. And I don't think the military as an institution sees its interests as entirely congruent with those of the neocons or the neoconservatives.
Certainly not. On the other hand, and, I would have said going into this administration what you've kind of suggested, which is that, it looks like Trump is going to be relying on military advice inordinately because he's got a former general as Secretary of Defense. And now, weeks into his administration, he acquired a still serving general as head of National Security Council.
And not, incidentally, not just inordinately, but also apparently in ordinance after yesterday's...
Inordinately, yes, if we can coin a new adjective.
Yeah.
The military, the irony of generals has long been that actually they're not that enthusiastic about war. Maybe that's an oversimplification, but often the voices of caution when somebody wants to launch a war come from the military, because they've been there and they know it's not easy. And so I was kind of thinking, well, good, we got a couple of generals here, we can expect a certain amount of caution and a kind of a realist influence. On the other hand, in this particular case, one of the biggest questions is, do you go to war with a proxy or an ally or a proxy of Iran's? And as it happens, the James Mattis, the Secretary of Defense, has kind of a thing about Iran, and we're starting to hear things. We can talk about this Bloomberg View piece in a little bit about McMaster. We're starting to hear that even McMaster is entertaining notions of substantial intervention in Syria. So, aren't we seeing a kind of, just through happenstance almost, a kind of unlikely congruence between the views of this particular military, the kind of military guidance Trump is getting from the military, and the more interventionist, certainly including neoconservative, opinion that we should work to undermine the Syrian regime, if not even go further and work to undermine the Iranian regime?
Well, there certainly is a degree of convergence. And there certainly is a strong anti-Iran convergence. That much is true. Mattis has made no secret, and for that matter, Votel, who's the head of Central Command, has made no secret of their desire to, in the vernacular, push back, on quote-unquote, against Iran in the region on behalf, in major part, of their Gulf allies. And I think it has more to do with the Gulf allies than it does with Israel, from their point of view.
Oh, yeah.
From the neocon point of view, it's mostly about Israel, I believe. I think that's just a core pillar of neoconservatism, is Israel is absolutely important, and the defense of Israel is absolutely important. They don't care that much about the Gulfies, except insofar as the Gulfies cooperate or don't cooperate with Israel. But at the same time, Mattis has also made clear he doesn't want to see the JCPOA, the nuclear agreement,
with Iran,
put aside.
Right.
So what they want to do is they want to push around Iran and its various allies, that includes militias like in Iraq, to the extent that they can without jeopardizing the JCPOA. for the neoconservatives, they don't care about the JCPOA. They're not going to say right now they want the JCPOA thrown out, but they're going to do everything they can to make that the result, acting primarily through Congress is the assumption. But I don't think the military is for that. And also with respect to Syria, I mean, to the extent that Eli Lake's article, I mean, that we need to take it seriously.
And we should say what that said. We haven't really made that clear. But basically, Eli, and I think I'm going to be having a conversation with him on Blogging Heads about this soon, but he did a piece quoting sources, anonymous sources, saying that McMaster, National Security Advisor, General McMaster, was floating ideas, which wasn't clear that McMaster necessarily embraced them, as opposed to just wanting to, you know, air a full range of possibilities, but was floating ideas about sending 10,000 or even more American troops, boots on the ground, into Syria, which would be a pretty radical departure from what we've been doing, and just as radical a departure from what Trump was saying before the election. So that's the Eli Lake piece.
Right. And the question is, well, what's the goal of inserting those troops? To me, it's not clear at all, even from the article, that they are to oppose the regime or to contribute to its overthrow. To me, what he's saying, or what's being said in there, is they want to defeat, in however you define that word, ISIS. They want to extract it from Raqqa and make sure that no other part of Syria, I guess, becomes a refuge for ISIS. But I read the article as meaning that for political and diplomatic reasons, the way to defeat ISIS, the only way to defeat ISIS in a way that doesn't, for example, completely alienate Turkey, is for U.S. troops to go on the ground so that Kurdish forces, which have led the forces against ISIS in the Raqqa area, are not, don't themselves enter Raqqa or do not take over Arab, primarily Arab villages and so on, because Sunni Arab villages, because that will only make things worse.
Because it will alienate the Arabs.
Yeah, I mean, yes, because where the Kurds have gone, generally speaking, Arabs have not fared well. The Sunni Arabs have not fared well, yeah, even though they're co-sectarian.
Of course, yes, there's a history of Arabs not being enthusiastic about American occupation either in recent history. But whatever, I guess they would, not to mention the fact that then it would be our mess on our, that we'd have on our hands. But whatever, the idea did seem to be part of the idea.
Yeah, and I think, you know, Eli is one of those, and Eli's sources are those like Jack Keane, which seemed to be his main source. He was a general and very closely tied to the neocons.
He also quoted anonymous sources actually in the administration, but the one on the record source was, yes, a retired general who is said to be close to McMaster.
And who's one of the architects of the search. I mean, mm-hmm. Eli and these people, and that may include McMaster because he was involved, believed that the surge was a great success, and the only thing that prevented it from being a complete success was the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq in 2011. And if they had stayed, ISIS would not have risen, and everything would be copacetic. I personally don't think that's a very persuasive understanding or interpretation of the surge, but he and his sources believe the surge worked, and we can do something similar in Syria and even in Iraq again. And that's kind of the neocon position at this point.
That is that is a mainstream neocon position, that sending troops into Syria would be a good idea.
I think that's a mainstream neocon position.
But not necessarily for regime change, although...
No, they would like to see it related to regime change. They see Assad as a great or greater threat than ISIS, because they see Assad as the key link between Iran and Hezbollah, geographically, if for no other reason. So if you can get rid of Assad, in their view, you can isolate, you can cut the link between the arms supply link, the missile supply link between Iran and Hezbollah. You can isolate Hezbollah, and Israel is more secure. I think that is their main interest.
So just geographically, it would be harder for Iran to get weapons to Hezbollah if there was an anti-Iranian regime in Syria.
That's right. And their interest in regime change is really directed at the Iran Hezbollah connection, because mm-hmm. Hezbollah does represent a real threat to Israel. It's a mythical threat. They have over 100,000 missiles, well over 100,000 mm-hmm. missiles.
Although they do seem to respond to the conventional logic of deterrence.
Yeah, there's nothing that I'm aware of that indicates that Hezbollah is immune to those conventional laws.
And I think we've seen deterrence work. But at the same time, look, if I were in Israel and I knew that they had 100,000 missiles, I'm sure I would rather they didn't.
It's worth pointing out that Iran and Hezbollah have shown an interest in Syria, because they are in Syria, in moving toward the Golan, which is occupied by Israel. And that makes...
Which is former Syrian territory.
Well, under international law, it remains Syrian territory. But it makes Israel very nervous, because it puts those missiles much closer range mm-hmm. to the heart of Israel than they are in southern Lebanon.
Okay. So that's all interesting. So in your scenario, neoconservatives would welcome what was being floated in that article. And the initial rationale might be that for a kind of an anti-ISIS surge. But in your view, neoconservatives would, many of them would in the long run, welcome its evolving into something that successfully changed the regime in Syria. Ideally, I'm sure in the least violent way possible. You know, maybe through intimidation or something. But still,
you can argue that there are certainly people in the military, including I would imagine Mattis, who would say, if we put more skin in the game, literally skin, mm-hmm. We can demonstrate to the Russians and to the Iranians that they're not going to win militarily. And if we can demonstrate that to them in very convincing ways, then they will acquiesce eventually in a political solution that could remove Assad, and that could reduce. That may be desirable from their point of view.
Well, if Mattis feels that way, why should we not expect that this will in fact happen? That we'll see 10,000, 20,000 American troops in Syria?
Well, because I think the military as an institution apprehends a high degree of risk in doing that. Risk not only to the well-being of their soldiers, but to their own, to the patience of the American public. Because the American public, their basic view is very similar or the same as in 2013, when the question was whether Obama was going to carry through on his threat to attack or to do something with respect to chemical weapons use then. And the public, both Republican and Democratic said, we're not interested. We do not like this, and Congress would not vote in favor of it.
Okay.
And I don't think things have changed in in the absence of a major terrorist attack here on the mainland, I just don't think that the public's patience for a major commitment of American blood and treasure has changed.
Now. Right, but there's very likely to be, if not what you would call a major terrorist attack, a significant terrorist attack that is done in the name of ISIS. We're likely to see that within the next year or two because it's gotten to the point, I think we could have avoided this, but we are at the point where homegrown terrorism happens every once in a while. It's fairly likely to be done in the name of ISIS. So, I mean, if the Trump administration is looking for an excuse to say, okay, we have to go after ISIS hammer and tong, you can well imagine several dozen Americans dying at the hands of someone who has professed allegiance to ISIS.
I can imagine that, but then if you insert 10 or 15 or 20,000 troops into Syria before then to wipe out ISIS, and then an attack occurs, I mean, it's just a little different. I mean, why would Trump or the military be eager to insert that number of troops, which would be seen as a very, very, as you point out yourself, as a major escalation in U.S. intervention? Aren't there political risks that would be undertaken as a result of that?
I think so. On the other hand, a couple of things. I mean, Mattis might not care as much about the political risk per se as people right around the president. Trump is getting positive reinforcement so far for military escalation, at least in the case of this strike. Who knows where that will lead? I don't know. I'm not particularly saying it's likely. I'm just kind of trying to flesh out the argument. Now maybe we should move on to kind of Trump's psychology and how that might play out in various places, including North Korea. But first, to stick with Mattis in the region, I've read some things Mattis said suggesting that he actually thinks ISIS and Iran are like kind of secret allies or something. And I don't understand the logic. I don't understand. I mean, I've heard some of the things he said, right? But to back it up, but they don't seem to make sense to me. I mean, is this your reading of his worldview? And does it make sense to you?
Well, I think he said something to that effect in April of 2016 at CSIS, where he said that it was no coincidence that ISIS hadn't attacked Iran.
Right.
But it was just like one sentence, and I don't know whether kind of his words got ahead of him. I just don't know. I haven't seen that theme developed by him.
Well, it's pretty, it's hard to imagine what else it could mean.
I'm sorry.
Well, go ahead, no.
I mean, he's definitely got a grudge against Iran that dates back to the Marine Barracks bombing in 1983
right.
in Beirut. I mean, he definitely wants to push back against Iran.
Right.
But I don't think he wants a war. I don't think he wants a war with Iran because that would involve an incredible commitment by the United States in the Middle East. And remember, this is all happening at a time when the threat of Russia and China is kind of inflating, you know. I mean, in 2013 it was one thing, but now people talk more about especially Russia and this in light of Ukraine, somewhat less on China and the South China Sea and the East China Sea. And so on, but there's like a lot of attention focused now on North Korea and China's alleged lack of cooperation and so on. And so the threat environment is more varied than it was like 5 years ago. So why get us more involved in yet another war in the Middle East when these other seemingly somewhat larger threats are impending? I mean, at the same time, it may be that the military or someone like Mattis wants to make a major statement about U.S. military power, and Syria may be seen as too puny or defenseless to make that statement, and North Korea is too scary, especially for South Korea, to make the statement there, although you have today this report of a possible preemption of a nuclear test, which is now being denied by the Pentagon. And then, so the logical kind of middle power that you want to beat up, if you want to beat someone up, is Iran. And I'm concerned about that kind of thinking. Mm-hmm. And that certainly is a place that the neocons would like to go.
Okay. So as for Trump's current psychology, I mean, so he launched these missile strikes against Syria, and a couple of things struck me. One is how readily the media embraced the official explanation that Trump had been so moved by these pictures of suffering children that he had felt compelled by conscience to act. Whereas there's an entirely plausible, cynical, political explanation, right? I mean, this is like, the guy is, one of his main political threats is the perception that he is a Russian pawn, right? What better way to illustrate that he does not bow down to the Russians than to do something they really didn't want done? Not to mention the fact that in general, when you launch attacks like this, you get a little boost in public opinion. I'm relieved to say personally that he doesn't seem to have gotten a very big one, but in public approval, but he did get broad applause across the spectrum of foreign policy elites, with only a few exceptions. And so that's the other thing I would mention, aside from the way the media responded to this, is just that he got, even without a big Gallup bump, which he doesn't seem to have gotten, he got something he had been totally lacking for the entire history of his administration up to that point, which is bipartisan applause from elites. He got a kind of positive reinforcement he has not gotten for anything else. And that, given that Trump above all wants applause, right? And seems to have no, so far as I can tell, actual convictions about foreign policy. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm selling him short. Or anything else. Although, you know, I've heard people say, no, actually, you can go back 10 years and find him talking economic nationalism or this and that. So who knows? But I worry where the positive reinforcement could lead. You know, if he gets applause every time he exercises military force, and, you know, I worry about a little in the case of North Korea. I mean, I think you're right. The idea of preemption is very unlikely. And I think that was probably just bad reporting or mixed signals or something. At the same time, if he's sending this, whatever he's sending over to North Korea, is it a carrier fleet or what is it? It's a carrier fleet. Seemingly, well, in response to the expectation of North Korea provocations, suppose North Korea does go ahead and do a test of a nuclear weapon underground, it's going to leave Trump in a pretty awkward place politically, right? Now, that may not happen, but I'm going to have trouble imagining Trump restraining himself from doing something kind of demonstrative.
I agree with you. It scares the hell out of me. And I'm sure the South Koreans are petrified.
Yeah, because by conventional reckoning, if there is a war, a whole bunch of South Korea, you know, North Korea would probably not win. And the ultimate question would be how the U.S. and China work things out. But supposedly, in the first instance, a bunch of South Koreans would die. I suspect the estimates are perhaps a little on the high side. But you hear like, you know, there would be a meat grinder, 100,000 South Koreans would die. I suspect that's a little high, but you know, if it's a lot less than that, I imagine South Korea would still be pretty upset about it.
I would imagine. Yeah, I find it very, very frightening. But on your point about the blob, as it's called, and their reaction to military action on the part of Trump in Syria. I mean, I think a lot of that has to do with fear of Bannon and the America First and hatred of fear and loathing. And if Bannon is actually gone, or if perception that his influence on foreign policy has been completely neutralized. I would tend to believe that the blob would begin to fracture somewhat and you would get more criticism. I think it's the coincidence of this military action with the demise, or the reported demise of Steve Bannon, that prompts the foreign policy establishment to try to give positive reinforcement to Trump. It's an act of seduction and relief.
Well,
as well as what you say, which is there are naturally hawkish instincts in the blob.
What does that sound mean you're late for? Is that a calendar alert you're getting?
No, I'm just getting email, I think.
Oh, I see.
Sorry.
That's okay. sounds like you're getting a lot. Okay, but I don't know. That I guess that I might consider that encouraging if you're right. I don't know what the evidence for it is. I mean, if you look at some of the liberal elites who praised Trump, I mean, Anne-Marie Slaughter, pretty predictable, regardless of whether there's a Steve Bannon.
Yes.
What's his name? David Ignatius. That's pretty predictable, right?
But that is an act of seduction. I mean, I think Ignatius is very calculated.
But you don't think he would have supported it, like if Obama did it, or?
Oh, I think he has helped create the consensus that Obama should have acted.
Right. So fine. So I mean, in other words, that's not a Bannon-driven reaction by David Ignatius.
No, but you can see expressed in him over the last months. Great concern about Bannon's influence, and hence great relief to hear that maybe his influence has been curtailed or eliminated.
Sure, but I mean, I'm just not so sure that when Bannon's gone, you're going to see much decline in the positive reinforcement Trump gets from liberals for stuff like this. And if you look at Nicholas Kristof, who applauded it, and is not a classic liberal interventionist, he is a classic emoter.
Yes.
Yeah, you know, so he's like, with him, I think what they claim happened with Trump really did happen. He saw the pictures of kids. We must do something. Let me put it this way. Give me an example of a liberal elite who applauded the missile strikes, who you think would not have applauded them had Bannon and Bannonism already vanished from the face of the administration.
I think there would have... Well, I can't think of one offhand, in part because I'm a little behind in my reading on this. But I suspect there would be more skepticism expressed about what this really showed about Trump, and also necessarily about the wisdom, for example, of not consulting allies, about the wisdom of acting so quickly without additional evidence. I mean, this is something that I imagine we'll see over the next days and weeks, is, you know, what was this such a smart move? I think there'll be some second thoughts to that, and I think you'll see some indication of, if not dissent, just of skepticism and concern.
Well, I think unless it leads to something manifestly bad, I don't think there's going to be much recalibration personally on the part of... I think two things could change liberal opinion significantly. One would be if, say, Russia feels a need to do something provocative in response, which they don't seem to feel, or they would have probably done it by now, and then Trump is boxed in and he does something provocative. You know, that kind of... Anything escalatory could cause people to rethink. And then the other thing is, you know, there's still murmurings about whether the interpretation of the chemical weapons attack was right, whether it really was the Syrian. You know, there's this post by this, you know, noted guy in the arms control community, Theodore, is it Postol?
Postol.
We can link to that, arguing that the evidence isn't really consistent with a strike by Syrian Assyrian jet, although it should be noted, his interpretation is not consistent with what the Russians claim happened, which is that there was the bombing of a chemical weapons warehouse that was actually in possession of the rebels.
That's right.
In any event, I mean, if it happened that there was a big... I mean, that would be the most... That would be very bad for Trump politically. That would be the most damaging thing, the biggest opinion changer, if it turned out, well, actually... it wasn't Syria that did this. But right now the odds seem against that verdict being overturned.
But, Bob, let me go back just a little bit. I mean, the reason I say that there's an attempt for some positive reinforcement or some seduction would be, I think, partially evidenced by the reaction of the Europeans. I think under normal circumstances, the Europeans would be pretty circumspect in reacting to this. In part because they weren't even consulted. Yet, what you've seen is support, like, across the board. And I think that's, I really do think that's an act of seduction. That they're trying to persuade Trump that they're not his enemy, that they can be friends, that everything can be okay, and they should be listened to.
Yeah, I think that's true, and some of that dynamic, to get back to like liberal elites, is almost inevitable because, you know, Washington is just completely full of people who aspire to have influence among, you know, powerful politicians, right? So like everyone there is thinking, especially you got somebody like Trump, whose whole worldview seems to be in play. It seems like Plato. It likes, who knows, maybe we could turn it into anything. So of course everyone in Washington is thinking, maybe I could be his next key advisor, right? And so there definitely is some of that. I'm just pointing out that with a lot of these people, that's not a necessary explanation because they just favor stuff like this.
No, I agree that the foreign policy establishment, the blob, the Washington playbook, as Obama referred to it publicly anyway, likes military action. And whenever there are surveys of elite opinion versus public opinion, they always show that elite opinion is generally more hawkish, more militaristic, more inclined to military action than the public as a whole. With the exception of certain specific kinds of circumstances. Mm-hmm. But yes, in order to get ahead in Washington, which is one reason why I've never gotten ahead in Washington.
But wait, you are the proprietor of Loblog. What do you mean? Do you know how many young kids, even today, are aspiring to someday be the proprietor of Loblog? And you, among all of them, have succeeded.
Yes, but Eli Lake is paid by Bloomberg.
Well, money isn't everything. Fortunately for every contributor to Loblog, including you.
No, that's true. But yes, there is a strong bias in favor of military action in the Washington playbook. There's no question about that. And you don't, generally speaking, people don't come to Washington because they're uninterested in obtaining some share of power. And that means some compromising vis-a-vis their feelings about military power. Mm-hmm. I mean, not in every case, but obviously some people come here quite disposed toward military power.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But so let's just close, though, on this. Like, more seriously, like, correct me if I'm wrong, you have not been offered a column on the op-ed page of the New York Times.
That is correct.
And just more broadly, I mean, my point is this, like, your perspective, it's not the only, there are many valid perspectives, I suppose, and certainly many well-informed and reasonably well-reasoned perspectives and so on. Let a thousand flowers bloom. But why is it that the perspective of people like you and me gets essentially no representation on kind of elite, you know, journalistic real estate, right? I mean, you look at the op-ed page, New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, you can go like a long way. I mean, including online publications. I mean, certainly, like, well, I don't want to name too many names, but you take my point, right? I mean, look, the New York Times just hired as a columnist Stephen Hayes, right?
No, Brett Stevens.
Oh, I mean Brett Stevens.
No, Stephen Hayes would be a little too far.
Would that be even worse?
Well, would it be worse? I mean, Brett Stevens is just a much better craftsman. Yeah. And he's not into. I mean, he's one smart guy, whereas Stephen Hayes, I think, is just a propagandist. Well, I mean, Stevens is a propagandist on behalf of Likud a lot of the time, but he's smart, and his writing is very smart. Okay. He's a very good polemicist. Steve Hayes isn't anything like that.
Okay, but... And I mean, I was thinking of the right one. I was thinking of the Wall Street Journal columnist, but I just and the former editor of the Jerusalem Post, right?
Right, Brett Stevens, yeah.
And you know, okay, fine. So he's a smart version of a neocon, but I mean, it's like, shouldn't there be one columnist at the New York Times or Washington Post, like a regular columnist? Really pays attention to foreign policy, is influential in that realm, who would like express skepticism about like a missile strike like this. And maybe I'm missing somebody. I don't know. There should be.
You can get someone like Charles Blow or Paul Krugman, but they're not foreign policy specialists. I would say in the Washington Post, you have Eugene Robinson, who's pretty consistent.
Okay.
Generally reflects our views.
Okay. Well, I guess I'll have to take that for now. Is there anything else you want to say about
this topic?
Yeah.
Well, I think that the most interesting, or one of the most interesting things to me I'm writing about right now is what would be the avenues into the administration that the neocons could use. And I think... Jared Kushner has proved to be extremely influential, and I think the Pentagon made a very specific decision that they would court Kushner. They took him to Iraq. They spent a lot of time with him, and that's when he came back that suddenly all these reports appeared that Bannon was out. Was no longer influential. Trump was furious with him, and so on. I don't think that was a coincidence. So, Kush may be one way in, and I don't profess to know what his views on Israel are. Although I'm sure he's quite favorable to Israel. And the Observer, when he was the publisher of it, were very pro-Israel, if not exactly pro-Likud or settlement position. So that's one avenue. The second avenue is through Mattis in terms of playing on the anti-Iran stuff. I found it really interesting that Sean Spicer, after talking stupid things about the Holocaust and chemical weapons, that he apologized to Sheldon Adelson.
Yeah, a Trump donor, very right-wing pro-Israel.
Well, he's the biggest Republican donor there is.
Yeah.
And that they even put out a statement from Adelson's headquarters saying that Spicer had called to apologize. That, to me, is very worrisome, because Adelson's somebody who has in the past, said that we should explode a nuclear weapon in the middle of the Iranian desert, what that is, where nobody lives to show its power. Very, very pro-BB, very pro-settler. But the fact that Spicer, it was suggested to Spicer, as I'm sure it was, that he apologized to Adelson, I think is very significant in terms of assessing what is essentially the medieval court of a minor duchy in the way that it operates.
So what do you think, Trump told him to apologize? I mean, do you think that the administration got blowback from Adelson right away? And
I think Adelson probably got blowback and let it be known that that this was not a good thing.
It was so weird because, you know, that talking point, what Spicer said was something like, even Adolf Hitler didn't use chemical weapons. And what he meant was, I guess it's known that Adolf Hitler chose not to use chemical weapons on the battlefield.
Right.
And, you know, that somebody else used that talking point. Somebody else from the administration used that talking point a couple of days before Spicer. Did you hear it then?
Because I didn't hear it, but it wouldn't have surprised me if Trump had said something.
Well, I forget who said it. It could have been Trump himself. But I remember thinking, like, you know, and then I saw the clarification, meaning, you know, you just mean on the battlefield, fine. But I thought, I can't believe somebody brought that out as a talking point, because obviously everyone's first reaction is, I think actually Hitler did use some poisonous chemicals, right? And it's just kind of bizarre that that didn't just pop into Spicer's head. That talking point had been sitting around on the shelf. It had been used once. And I don't know. I don't know
if it was actually written down. But the other thing I wanted to say, Bob, in terms of sources of influence, is Nikki Haley, too.
The UN ambassador.
The ambassador to the UN. I mean, she is depending on people like Lindsey Graham, who's very close himself to Adelson, and. I mean, it's in some ways a lot of this goes back to him, and he may be the avenue by which the neocons regain substantial influence. And there are so many positions in the administration at the undersecretary, assistant secretary, deputy assistant secretary levels that have not been filled, that their opportunities are really quite significant.
Well, this is why I was emphasizing that, you know, I think the Republican foreign policy establishment is largely neocon, because the way it seems to me is, like, when you ask who's going to fill the positions, I mean, it's almost like who else is there? Now, I know you say there is a little bit of a realist bench, maybe at CSIS or something, but it just seems to me like if you just randomly select somebody from the foreign policy establishment, or another way of putting it is who with influence is going to insist that these mid-level positions be filled by realists or something. We already know that Rex Tillerson wanted Elliot Abrams as his deputy.
Right.
And Abrams may be back in the running. He was rejected by Trump because he had criticized Trump. But of course, that was, we think, maybe Bannon's doing. Bannon called that to Trump's attention. Bannon's stock is dropping.
That's what Abrams says, yeah.
Yeah, and Abrams is now lauded the missile strikes conspicuously.
And lauded so, Jared Kushner's role.
Good thinking, Elliot. Good thinking. And so, you know, he may be back on board. But if Tillerson wanted a neocon in the first place as deputy, and, you know, Mattis at defense has this anti-Iran thing,
right?
Why should we expect anything that you would welcome filling the mid-level, you know, bureaucracy at defense or state?
Well, I think there are think tanks that are not neocon oriented, like CSIS, like Brookings, and some other places, and they do have a bench, as well as from the bureaucracies themselves. I mean, people can be promoted, which have a more realist outlook. But your point here is right. I mean, I don't think Tillerson was attracted to Abrams because he's a neocon. I think Abrams was sold to Tillerson because Abrams is a very effective bureaucratic player. And as Deputy Secretary of State, he would be effective at whatever it was that he was told to do. I think it was more that. I think if somebody had said, yeah, but this guy's real serious, kind of, quote, Israel firster, unquote, Tillerson might have hesitated. But I think it was because he really knows the bureaucracy and how to work the bureaucracy.
Yeah. Well, I'm not even sure Tillerson knows what a neocon is. I mean, it's turned out that he just didn't know much coming into office. But
right. And then that's kind of what I also worry about, because if he falters, it's clear that Nikki Haley is trying to position herself.
Mm-hmm.
To be Secretary of State. I mean, she even said that when she was first interviewed, it was for that position. And that worries me a lot, because that's Lindsey Graham.
Yeah, and in fact, Graham and McCain just recently were quoted as saying, you know, you can't, something like, you can't fight ISIS with Assad in power. So in other words, fighting ISIS means regime change in Syria, which is, you know, a neocon talking point.
Right.
Well, not talking point maybe, but
no, I mean,
sentiment.
Yes, absolutely. I just don't know that I would ever, I don't think McCain is a consistent neocon.
No, I don't think he is. I'm just saying on this point, Graham.
There's convergence, absolutely.
Yeah. No, McCain is it remains interesting. Graham is occasionally interesting. They're and in some cases have held out against aspects of Trumpism that you and I are probably not enthusiastic about. They're interesting, but
I mean, Brett Stevens, the new New York Times columnist, was anti-Trump from the outset.
Yeah, and I suspect that's one way the New York Times justifies this.
I suspect so, yes.
But I think, you know, we can. One thing that may be in the works is the rapprochement between some neocons and Trump, depending on how Trump behaves. The Syria strikes may have ushered that process in. We'll see.
Yeah, I think that's the question.
Okay, so as for those people who are going to complain in the comments section that there's a lack of ideological diversity in this conversation, I would say that the next conversation I have scheduled is with neoconservative Eli Lake. We give all people an opportunity on Blogging Heads TV.
He objects to that moniker.
Does he now?
Well, I don't know. Maybe not now, but we had an email exchange about 10 years ago, and he took very strong exception to my suggesting that he was closely associated. But maybe
I'll ask him about that.
Maybe he's come around to realizing who he really is.
I'll ask him about that. I didn't realize that.
Yeah, he does see himself as somewhat separate.
Well, I think for one thing, he considers himself a reporter, and he wants that, and not an opinion columnist, and he wants that identity to stand on its own, which is a reasonable thing for somebody like him to want.
Absolutely. Yeah, given his background. And he's a good reporter. When he reports.
Yep. And I'll tell him you said that.
He knows that I've said that. I've heard.
I'll bring your name up when I talk to him, and we'll see what transpires.
Okay.
All right. Well, thank you, Jim. I have learned a lot. I think this has been very fruitful. I hope people agree. We'll check in with you down the road after the apocalypse is closer.
Okay, Bob.
All right.
Thanks.
Take care.
Thanks for listening to Blogging Heads TV. You can help support this content by remembering to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. You can subscribe to all Blogging Heads episodes or to a specific program by going to our subscribe page at bloggingheads.tv/subscribe. There you can sign up for podcast downloads via iTunes or Stitcher, or you can subscribe to our email and we'll send you an alert every time we post a new episode.